At Delta, we know Mike in 8C prefers reality TV to reality. So we provide more than 1,000 hours of in-flight entertainment. On the next flight, 8C is Mandy, a foodie. So we offer all types of food options. Because at Delta, everyone flies their own way. Delta, keep climbing.
Who doesn't love a classic chocolate chip cookie? Famous Amos has been making them since the 70s, 1975 to be exact. With semi-sweet chocolate chips and a satisfying crunch, it's everything classic in one bite-sized cookie, and fans couldn't get enough. That's right. You'll find our original recipe, the one you know and love, in every bag of Famous Amos original chocolate chip cookies. Find Famous Amos anywhere you buy your favorite snacks.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Plus, auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Quote now at progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance and Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. The year is 2017, and imagine me speaking German now and asking you, is it better to podcast or to die? The movie, Call Me By Your Name. Everyone, and welcome to
Unspooled.
I am Paul Scheer, joined as always by my co-host Amy Nicholson. And boy, oh boy, I am excited to talk about today's film, which of course is Call Me By Your Name. Getting ready for the challengers. And I wanted to look back on a movie that introduced me to Luca Guadagnino. Amazing filmmaker who has made some interesting films. You really can't pin him down. Now, I know you've seen Challengers.
I have seen Challengers. It is a lot of movie. It is a lot of sweat and tennis rackets. Oh, my goodness.
Well, I love it. I've been playing tennis a lot, so I'm excited because I've also been having three-ways with my partners.
You will never look at a certain racket gesture the same ever again.
Oh, maybe I gotta hold off. But this movie, to me, I think what's interesting about Call Me By Your Name is really how it emotionally puts you in a place. I mean, this is a, you've heard the term fever dream. This is like a memory. This is, you know, we're in someone's past. It's gauzy, it's hazy, it's sensual. It gives you a feeling that I feel like most movies don't really do. And on a rewatch, I was blown away by it.
Yeah, I mean, this film I feel like has really dug into our consciousness over the last 7 years. I mean, it is a touchstone. You can even right now go to the part of Italy where this was filmed and take a tour called the Elio Loves Oliver Tour. Yeah, you can. It has, by the way, 5 stars on TripAdvisor. One reviewer was like, the guy even played the soundtrack to the movie on his car stereo. So, hey.
I love that you're driving around with a dude in a
when
car.
When a movie gets a tour, that's when you're like, yeah, movie gets a tour. Lost in Translation, got a tour. This is my new way of checking anything.
I'm laughing at it. And I'm also saying I would go on that tour. I'd like to see those spots. You know, what I also think is interesting about this film is for many people, this is the fuck the peach movie. And I want to get into why we talk about this movie in that way, because I think that scene is really beautiful. And I think the discourse around it is really dumb.
I agree. And I'm excited just to talk about like living with these characters in this moment in 1983. I mean, Luca, this film got so successful that he was like, I want to do sequels. I want to do 5 sequels.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want this to be my boyhood. And, you know, due to things, scandal noted, it is not.
Scandal noted.
And I think that is just fine. I like living here with these guys in
too.
This moment.
I agree with you. I don't need to see anymore. We don't need anymore. It would have been interesting, but that's not this movie. I think it actually lives on better as a one piece, not the One Piece, the anime film, but or the anime series, but just as a one piece. I think we don't need to go further. I think actually elongating it might actually dilute what's so special about it or what's so meaningful about this film.
Yeah, to love a relationship, you have to let it end.
And now, Amy, I will do what the film implores me to do, which is to unspool it. The year is 2017, and Luca Guadagnino is finally slowly rolling out a film that has taken him many slow years to make. Fittingly, Call Me By Your Name is a slow-burning summer romance between a teenager named Elio and a graduate student named Oliver at Elio's family villa in Italy. It's based on a novel by Andre Ackerman that was published in 2007. Now, Luca heard about the book in 2008 and from some producers who had already optioned it and wanted to consult him as an Italian to understand exactly where in Italy the book was set and how much it would cost to film on location. Now, Luca was a filmmaker himself, but he hadn't yet hit that point in his career where anyone was seriously considering him to direct. So he was just there to kind of give advice to whoever was going to direct Call Me By Your Name. But every time the pieces started to come together, the film would fall apart.
The film fell apart so much that the people who wanted to make it now very much understood getting your heart broken. Luca became invested in getting it done. So he had the idea to ask James Ivory to direct it. James Ivory is, of course, one half of Merchant Ivory. You know, they made all those high-class literary films that dominated the Oscars for years. Ivory came to this already with three Best Directing nominations for Room with a View, Howard's End, and The Remains of the Day. And he could use something to focus his attention on, as his longtime partner, Ismail Merchant, had just died. They'd been together for 44 years, both in love and in business. Luca agreed to co-write the script with Ivory, but when they finished actually writing the script, nobody wanted to finance the film. They thought that its $12 million budget was way too expensive. So Ivory asked if Luca would co-direct the film with him because he thought that way at least they could try to make it faster and cheaper. But nobody wanted to do that either. They thought that tag team sounded way too risky. So finally, after years and years and years, everyone realized that Luca should just direct the film himself.
Call Me By Your Name stars Timothée Chalamet as Elio and Armie Hammer as Oliver, with Michael Stuhlbarg and Amira Caesar as Elio's parents, and Esther Garrel as a local girl named Marzia, whose summer romance doesn't work out as well for her. Now, everyone spends the film getting into intellectual discussions and swimming and talking about art and the classics and eating lots of beautiful fruit from the garden. More on that later. Now, Elio and Oliver start off prickly, but gradually open up just in time for Oliver to leave and Elio to experience his first adult-sized heartbreak. At the time, Armie was the bigger actor, but no one in Hollywood seemed to know what to do with a 6'5" blonde guy who looked like a classic movie star and didn't seem to fit into the big movie star films that Hollywood had been trying to put him in, like The Lone Ranger or The Man from U.N.C.L.E. Or even, do you remember this, Amy? Mirror, Mirror, a Snow White remake? Yeah, it happened.
Oh, yeah.
Look it up.
He was like Prince Charming.
Oh, boy. Now, for Timothy, his career was on the rise. He had bits in Homeland and movies like Interstellar and Love the Coopers, but he hadn't reached the, I guess, the fan fervor that we now know of Chalamet.
Oh, no, he hasn't. But in the very long and patient rollout between Call Me By Your Name's Sundance premiere in January of 2017 to its tiny Oscar-qualifying run in the winter to its big, final, gigantic, wide release on January 19th, 2018, Timothy, Armie, Luca, they would all become major household names thanks to this movie, which solidified everybody's careers at the time, at least. I mean, Call Me By Your Name would go on to make $42 million, that is 12 times its budget, and get incredible reviews, 4 Academy Award nominations, including nominations for Best Picture, Best Original Song for Sufjan Stevens, Best Actor for 22-year-old Timothée Chalamet, and even James Ivory, he made out better than anybody because he won his Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay. So what was in the zeitgeist that January of 2018? It was a love song with a music video that was itself an ode to falling in love on vacation in the mountains of Europe, starring one of my own personal favorite rom-com queens, Zoe Deutsch. Here, with a tender ballad for a video filmed just 4 hours away from the set of Call Me By Your Name, it is Ed Sheeran and Perfect. When you said you looked a mess, I whispered underneath my breath, but you heard it, darling, you look perfect tonight. That song has now been stuck in my head ever since I figured that out.
Well, you know what's been stuck in my head is the amazing songs by Sufjan Stevens. Those songs, to me, encapsulate the mood of this movie. This movie is melancholy. This movie is like a slow Sunday afternoon. It feels hot. It feels alive. There's something about this movie that in the rewatch of it, I was surprised to still feel, because, you know, when you've seen a movie the first time, you kind of lose some of that surprise or maybe a little bit of that atmosphere that you get when you enter into a world. But wow.
You lose your film virginity when you watch
Yeah. And I felt like this film, it almost got richer in the rewatch. I found myself just sitting on my couch after watching this and just sitting in what I just saw, you know, and I think it's a really interesting thing that he, as a first-time director, or as a director with a, I should say, first-time, like, bigger budgeted film, is able to create such a distinct tone. Because in many ways, the camera work here is very simple. It's all shot on 35 millimeter in a wide, very basic shooting, and you get so much from that.
The funny thing about this Sufjan Stevens score is I remember feeling like it should not work at all, you know, because this is a mm-hmm. period piece. It's set in 1983. Sufjan Stevens is a modern artist. His songs don't sound like period songs. And yet he is, you know, the sound of this movie. And I was thinking, like, why? That feels like kind of a risk for a film that is taking place very much in this time. It turns out that part of the story of it is that when they were trying to condense this book from, you know, the giant epic that was going to cost them $12 million because it took place over decades and decades of Elio and Oliver's lives, one of the things they decided to cut was immediately, well, we can't do any of the stuff that takes place later. We have to do this, you know, only in this one year, only in this one moment. But what if Sufjan Stevens' love songs sound like the narrator from the future, kind of singing about the past and what these emotions felt like at the time? So that is sort of the idea of, like, somebody from our era looking back at this moment without announcing it.
And I think what you just said there is exactly what I'm talking about. It is a memory. This is a memory of a first love, a first heartbreak, discovering who you are. And when you look back on that, I do think you look back with not like rose-colored glasses, but like this hazy, you remember sensations, touch, ideas, words. And I feel like that is really what this movie does, is it puts you into the perspective of, this is looking back on something that defined me. And we don't know who Leo is. You don't know where he ends up. You know, the movie ends, you know, I would say, you know, the movie is essentially 28 days and ends maybe a couple months after that.
Well, it's like, it's a mood piece. I mean, it's kind of unusual, right, in terms of a narrative structure, because it's not a film where there's like any villains or where any rising action happens. It's not a rom-com with some sort of crisis or like, oh no, blah, blah, blah. Here come the developers and I don't think I can keep my, I'm trying to think, what's an Italian thing? I can't keep my tortellini store open. Yeah. It's
my
not
villa.
Like that. It's really just about the emotions that these guys are going through over the month. I mean, what's surprising about it and what's surprisingly effective about it is you're watching a movie about somebody feeling something. You know, you're just watching someone in their feelings. You're
yeah.
watching like a long take of Timothée Chalamet sitting by a fireplace, listening to this song and just feeling, crying, stopping crying, crying again, smiling, looking stronger, crying again. Is it a video? Is it a video?
And I'm watching that until it goes to up next on Hulu, right? I am watching that entire thing. I'm just caught up. Not since Michael Clayton have I loved just a camera on an actor's face for such a long time, where you're feeling like you're getting so much more of the movie without saying any words.
And a camera on a fly's face. I find it a little distracting that they just happen to have a fly there in the last take. And it's like buzzing around and you're like, fly, you're ruining this moment for me, fly.
But I don't think it is. I think the fly is very intentional. There's flies all over this movie. And, you know, my research for it, it's incredibly intentional because a fly's lifespan is 28 days. And I think that metaphorically, that's what they're going for.
Are you telling me that that's like a deliberate fly? That they,
oh,
did they
there are
put
flies
the fly
throughout
in?
The whole film. I mean, it's not just that scene.
Well, yeah, but in that scene, that's
yes.
a real fly. That's not like an accident?
No, that is deliberate choice. And I think
you're
it's
telling
beautiful.
Me that's like James Cameron redoing Titanic and adding a fly to make sure we get the emotions? That's a CG fly?
I mean, I don't know if it's a train fly. I don't know. who knows? Maybe I can't speak to the CGI nature of it, but I can speak to the idea that that is thematically a choice. You know, it is such a piece of the film that I think we keep on coming back to throughout. You know, again, it creates a sound, it creates this energy, but you see flies throughout this entire film. And I went back and looked and I saw more and more examples of it. It's very prominent at the end there.
I mean, okay, I can go with that because I do feel like this is a film where you really feel, hi, I'm Luca Guadagnino. I had 10 years basically to think about how I would tell this story. I really have. Everything in this film feels so deliberate, you know? Like,
yeah.
What I really love about how it sets up everything is, you know, we're in Timothée Chalamet's bedroom. He's looking down at Oliver, who's just arrived. He's going to take over his bedroom for the summer, which is such a funny thing for a kid to be mad about, because I remember that feeling. I don't want to share my bedroom, you know? And then you become an adult and you're like, oh, I just wish I had somebody to share my bedroom with me, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. And you see that first shot of like Army climbing out of a tiny car, 6'5" Army climbing out of a tiny European hatchback, which is all I want to drive. And I really wish they would just make new versions of that car I could have here in Los Angeles. And everything in this first setup is just like, here is a guy showing up at my villa who takes up so much space. He doesn't fit in the doorways. He steals my mom's seat at breakfast. He's in my bedroom snoring like a monster.
This is like Goldilocks and the Three Bears, but if they all fucked.
Wow. Sure. Put it on the poster.
but you know what I think is so interesting is he comes in so clearly as being different. And I love how awkward and big he is, because immediately he is someone who doesn't fit in, right? He is the odd man out, but yet he's incredibly good looking, but he seems oddly savage, not as refined or as interesting as this family, even though we know him to be smart. He is immediately, I think, at least through Elio's eyes, looked down upon, not only for his presence, but what he projects.
Yeah, like he gets to show us that he has brains when he gives that whole, let me talk etymology for a second speech.
I'm going to talk etymology, so just bear with me a second. You're right in the case of most Latin words do find their origins in Greek words. However, in the case of apricot, it's a little bit more of a complicated journey.
Ah, how so?
Well, here the Greek actually takes over from the Latin. Latin word being praecoquam or praecoquere, so to precook or pre-ripen, as you know, to be precocious or premature. And the Byzantines, to go on, then borrowed praecox, which became praecocia, which then became berecoci, which is how the Arabs got al-barkuk.
But really what we're seeing is just that this is a guy with a tremendous unapologetic appetite. You know, he's like, I'm going to chug this apricot juice. Oh, you're going to pour that person some water? I'm taking the water out of your hand and chugging it myself. Oh, I can't crack eggs at the breakfast table because I'm an American who doesn't understand how to eat soft-boiled eggs. This is actually a fear that I have. I'm terrified to eat a soft-boiled egg in public. I know I'll screw up like knocking off the shell. Sorry, I grew up eating them scrambled. And so there's that little comedy of like him screwing up the first egg, you know, the housekeeper bringing him another egg, him devouring that egg and them saying, do you want another egg? And he was like, no, I am a man with such appetite. I cannot trust myself to have a second egg.
And what I love about this choice, it is showing a type of person who embraces everything about life. I think that oftentimes we look and like, I don't want to be a burden. I don't want to push people out of the way. But this is a guy who falls into a bed, cracks down and just zonks out. Like he takes what he wants. He lives life to the fullest. And to me, that end scene, which is all about the father and son talking about a life, and we'll get into that more, but I'm just saying that one of the themes in there, and there's a lot, is live your life to the fullest. Just embrace what you want, take what you want, and don't question it. There's an element there that he is setting the tone. And if you do that, you might get hurt as well, but it's worth it. It's worth it to drink all that, you know, juice or to upset people, because you are at least being authentic and you're not trying to be something that you're not. And I think that that's what this movie is about. It's a young boy trying to figure out who he is, pretending to be something he's not, faced with someone who is so confident in who he is that it creates this immediate, very rom-com situation. I mean, that's the rom-com. You have the uptight businessman meeting the crazy flighty girl, you know, his girl Friday to the odd couple to whatever. You know, it's like it's a traditional thing just done, you know, a little bit more elevated.
Well, yeah. I mean, we talked last week and when we were doing our episode on her about how Samantha the phone encourages Joaquin Phoenix's character, you know, his Theodore Twombly, to get out, to do things, to go out into the world. And I like watching Oliver through Elio's eyes, being like, that guy just, he hears a song he wants to dance to and he just goes and dances it. He sees some old guys playing cards and he just sits down at their table and makes himself fit in. Like, he looks at a situation that, to me, I'd be way too shy to do anything about. That to Timothy, his character is way too shy to do anything about it.
Oh, absolutely. Same.
And he's like, I'm going to show you how it's done. And that he inspires Timothy to do some dancing. And when you watch Timothy dance, he's a little bit more self-conscious. But that idea, you're right, this is a classic idea, because maybe part of what we do when we pick out a person who's good for us to date is we get crushes on qualities that they have that we wish we had.
Right.
Like, my boyfriend is much more emotionally open than me. That's amazing. I like dating him because it helps me work on that muscle, you know?
Absolutely. I think that that's such a big part of connection, right? This person has something that is pulling you in, but not repulsing you, but making you question your own way of being. Oh, I would never do that, but I'm kind of interested that they are. You know, how can they do that? I wouldn't, you know, it's this.
Yeah. Aren't they kind of rude? Aren't they kind of arrogant? I don't know if I like him doing that, which is like, would I be rude? Would I be arrogant if I was trying this?
At Delta, we know Mike in 8C prefers reality TV to reality. So we provide more than 1,000 hours of in-flight entertainment. On the next flight, 8C is Mandy, a foodie. So we offer all types of food options. Because at Delta, everyone flies their own way. Delta, keep climbing.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
And I love this title, Call Me By Your Name. And I didn't really give it that much thought. And, you know, I think there's a lot of different people who will talk online and say, well, you know, if you say Call Me By Your Name, it's saying I love you as much as I love myself. But then I found this idea that was online about Plato's Symposium, that in Greek mythology, humans were created as four-armed, four-legged, two-faced creatures, but split apart by Zeus and commend to spend life searching for their other halves. In the Symposium's rendering, whether one searches for a female or a male half has to do with the nature of your original being. And this idea of them finding their other half, I think was really interesting. That's true love. And I've always heard like, oh, your person, your partner, your other half. I never really understood what that meant. And I think that that term, Call Me By Your Name, is such a perfect encapsulation of that. We are one.
Wow, that is so literary and so apropos for a film where sometimes I'm watching everybody talk to each other and being like, I don't think this group of people would welcome me in. I might not have read.
Amy, you are this is how I view you. You would fit in perfectly.
I don't even speak two languages. I've got like one and then fragments of a bunch of ones that I actually can't. I sound like a 2-year-old in. you know, that these people are classy. But you are right about the fact that like when it comes to Elio and Oliver, they're not bonding over sitting down and being like, let's talk about Greek philosophy. They're kind of in a way using intellectualism as a competition. You know, like, I know this. Do you know this? Do you know this? I know this. And it's not really so much a source of bonding because in this world, everybody's just smart. My mother's reading me German stories. You know, this is how it goes. Like, where they bond is actually almost in the opposite. When, like, Elio finally opens up to Oliver and says, you know what? I don't know anything.
I know nothing, Oliver.
Well, you seem to know more than anybody else around here.
Well, if you only knew how little I know about the things that matter.
What things that matter?
You know what things.
But, I mean, that's also him saying, I'm a virgin, right?
I don't Like, I hear that, like, some people interpret the film as, like, he loses his virginity to Marzia when he, like, comes very fast. And I think Timothée Chalamet does a very good job of muttering nervously in French as though, you know, that just happened to him. But I get confused because, like, the film opens with him in his bedroom with a girl and they're putting their clothes on. So, what?
I feel like he has gotten close, but he hasn't really sealed the deal because he does announce, you know, he comes down, you know, and says, oh, you know, I had sex with, or I almost had sex with Marzia, you know, and then dad's like, well, why didn't you do it? You know, yeah.
And I was like, better look next time.
And I think there's something interesting at the core of this, which is like his family is very open about sexuality and they're ready to embrace. Clearly, I think his mom and dad know that he's gay. Or at least are willing to acknowledge what's going on here, right? They're not oblivious to it. The dad brings him on that excavation, I think, because he sees it, like he's helping it, and he's supportive of it. So I think that there's a part of Elio which is trying to be something that he's not, right? Like he might be getting in the situations with women that want to do that with him, and it never fully comes together for whatever reason. I don't know. There's a part of me that either he is saying, I'm a virgin, and I believe that because then why show that scene in the woods if he is not? And then on top of it, he's saying, like, I'm a virgin, and I'm also not sure that I'm gay.
Or I'm bi because he obviously gets excited for both people.
Yeah, and I think he's a kid. He's a child, and by having this relationship with Marzia, like, it creates this other sense. It's like that idea, like that in psychology, right? The idea that the person with the least amount of interest in the other has the more power in the relationship, right?
Well, you get also, I think, those two parallel sequences where, you know, Marzia with him is a little bit awkward, studying his face, trying to figure out how he wants her to behave. That you see in it that he doesn't have a lot of tenderness with her. In a way that just breaks my heart, you know, because I remember being like a young Marzia and like confused. Do I think this person likes me? They're giving me books. They say they want to hang out with me. I know their family. What's going on? But I also feel like there's something that's just not really right here. And then when we see him with Oliver, he's in that position. He's the one studying his face, you know, being like, is this good? Is this good? What about this? And like, he's kind of put on his heels. And to see his personality change like that, I mean, I also wanted to say, like, part of what I like about this movie is that, you know, it's not idealized in that they're both Oliver and Elio are kind of jerks to people, you know, often. Like, I really hate how they both treat, and I'll call it the help because I feel like that's how they treat her, you know, the housekeeper. I think that's how they treat Mafalda. Not a lot of thank yous, a lot of running in, a lot of leaving messes, a lot of throwing peach pits and trash on the floor, you know?
Well, it's the perfect version of intellectualism, right? Oh, we're so caring. We're so connected. We're understanding the world, but yet we treat the people in our lives like they're our servants.
Yeah.
It's an interesting dichotomy.
It is. And I respect that, you know, because we get to see the little levels of it. Like when he gets a nosebleed and he like goes to the fridge to get some ice and then there's no ice. It looks like, I don't know, frozen pig feet or something like that.
Right.
He glares at Mafalda, like, how dare you not have ice in the freezer? And then he wanders off and she gives him a little glare that he never sees because he didn't even close the freezer, you know? And like I like that because I hate it when we make our characters too perfect. You know, so getting to see this kind of running snobbery they have, this running arrogance, I think is good balance. And then also getting to see, man, what a jerk he is to Marzia. And then when she tells him that she loves him anyway, I'm like, really, Marzia? You got to go meet some new guys.
Do you think that she is saying to him at the end, I know you're gay?
I think she is because when they go off on that road trip, you hear the mom, the mom who seems to know everything, kind of mutter that she's going to have Marzia and the girl that Oliver sort of been seeing over for dinner. She's like, come for dinner. And you kind of sense that something happened at the dinner. She was like, girls, it's not you. You're great.
Yeah, I think that the parents are protective of all the children in this movie, which is really interesting because I think in an American film, you know, parents are like, I don't want you to have sex and I don't know what is going on in my kids' lives. And these parents are acutely.
Oh, yeah. And if like, somebody broke their kid's heart, they'd be like, well, I'm firing you. And how dare you? You know,
these guys are acutely aware.
Yeah. They're kind of like, it's good for our son to grow up a little and have his heart broken.
in many respects, like this is a European coming of age story, all the familiar beats, but just done slightly differently. And, you know, this is a time, you said it's in the past. There's this conversation between the father and Elio where he goes, do you have an issue with my friends who are clearly gay? And there's this, it's not fully accepted. It's not in the norm. His dad is very open to it. But this idea that like his parents are, I think they're looking at it purely as, look at this love and enjoy this love and be in this love. And that's such a unique distinction, I think, between a European parent and a, you know, an American parent. Like, I think that they are just like, they want their kids to have this emotion and find this true feeling.
Yeah. I mean, like Luca has this really sweet line about the dad. You know, some people have like told him in interviews, you know, wow, your dad is such a radically like open-minded person in this film. You know, he says, if his speech to his son about knowing yourself and being okay with yourself because it doesn't matter is a radical position for a father, then may we all be radicalized. You know, and I think even to get to the softness of that idea, he even took some stuff out of the script where like the parents talk about, you know, should they be worried about HIV? And here he takes that out too. You know, this, he just wants this. His goal was to make this a lovely film that doesn't have to bring in all the, you know, anxious negativity and the muttering that people add to stories that just happen to take place between two queer characters.
And what I think is so interesting is that people read that scene between the father and Elio as the father coming out to Elio and saying, I'm gay. And, you know, the author has come out to say, well, no, that was never my intent. Even in the sequel book, the father is divorced from the wife. It has nothing to do with homosexual tendencies. And I believe that what you're talking about here is exactly the issue. Like, can't a father have that conversation with his son without him being gay? Because I think that this movie, and here's my hot take, yes, it's about a queer relationship, but it really is just about love. It is universal because of that. I think this movie is beloved because of that. And this father is talking to his son about love. It doesn't matter who it is. And you can watch that speech and you can hear the words. And I watched it last night and I was like, I see him saying he settled for his mom.
Oh, I hope not.
Not for another man, but yeah. But not for, but like, I didn't chase after that person that engaged me in that way. I didn't chase it. Like, I, not that it's a bad relationship. And again, I think that there's like levels here, but I do think it is about love. It doesn't make a difference if it's a man or a woman. It is about heartbreak and love. And really, societal norms don't play a large part in this, in my opinion. It's there, obviously, but I think it's way more universal than that. And I think that it does show how close-minded we are that a father could have that conversation. If you look at it as saying a straight man having a conversation with his queer son about love, he has to be queer as well, is like, to me, that's just our own prudeness.
I can see that. I mean, I appreciate that this film is really digging in its heels in the idea that, you know, actually, as Armie even says in this scene, he doesn't want anything bad to happen to anybody.
I don't want you to regret anything. And I hate the thought that maybe I may have messed you up. I don't want either of us to pay for this.
No, it's not like I'm gonna tell anyone. You're not gonna be like in any trouble.
That's not what I'm talking about.
I mean, really, this is like about a love story that does remind me of Her Last Week, because it's about what happens when you allow yourself to love and then that relationship ends. And then you have to do the work to realize you've become a better person, deeper person, by going through that experience, as painful as it was. I mean, oh, I hate to even say this out loud because it scares me so much to say it out loud, but every relationship ends unless you die together in a fiery car wreck, right? Every relationship ends somehow, some way, which is right. A terrible idea. And I don't want people to feel this kind of thing we get steeped in, that when a relationship ends, it's a failure. Like, it's just what happens, you know? And if
yes,
we could grapple with the whole range of those emotions, that's an emotional power. That's great for us. And it's a universal thing, you know, relationships ending.
Right. And it's also, the idea that, like, don't protect yourself so much. You know, I think we can always find ways to be like, well, that doesn't make sense. Like, I can look fondly back on relationships that I had that lasted very short periods of time that brought me so much joy and were incredibly special. And it doesn't say that it takes away from the relationship that I have or was better than it, but it is like, you should feel the full gamut of these things. Like, you become a better person as someone who has a broken heart, who is someone who, you know, even wonders what if, you know, maybe it's not going to change your life, but it, like, you should have these pulls and pushes, but you should never feel like you didn't try or you didn't chase it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you may never catch it, but at least you chased it.
Yeah. Like, I have a friend who, like, when we had both gotten out of college, we went to different colleges. We met in LA. I went through my first bad breakup in LA and I was crying to my friend. And he told me a story about how when he was in college, you know, he had had the same boyfriend all through college. And it was a high pressure relationship at his college back then because they were kind of the first queer couple that most of their friends knew. And so they were together like the whole time and they broke up their senior year. And when they broke up, like, he just went into an absolute tailspin. And the way he got through just having this really public, horrible, you know, emotional state happen to him was he told himself that he was going to let himself feel every single corner of it. You know, that if he wanted to wake up in the morning and write terrible poetry, he was going to wake up in the morning and he was going to write terrible poetry and he would read that poetry and he would cry about the poetry. And then someday he would look at that poem and it would make him laugh a little bit. And when he finally got there, he knew he had worked through it.
Yeah.
But that if this was the most important relationship he'd had in his life, he didn't want to also rob himself of the impact of the breakup. And he was giving me this advice. And I was like, oh my God, you're a genius. You know, like, I once went through a breakup where that weekend I went to my friend's house and I sat there and I watched The Notebook on repeat the entire time. And I cried the entire time until I felt like I had finally cried a lot of the emotions out. That kind of thing is hard for me. I don't like to cry, you know?
Yeah, I remember you're feeling sorry for yourself. You're wrestling with all this sort of stuff and it should fuck you up. It should make you stare in front of a fireplace, you know, on Hanukkah. Like, you know, this is to me, that end moment, two things can be true, right? Are they perfect for each other? Now, look, there's an age difference. So I know a lot of people say, oh, well, it's a problematic movie because, look, in the book, it's like, what, 17 and 20 or 21.
24,
in real life,
I think, yeah.
Yeah. You know, and in the movie, you know, Chalamet's 20 and Armie Hammer is 29, right? But, you know, it's like, I think it's not about, like, age, but I think people look at it and go, it's manipulation. He manipulated him. He groomed him. And that to me is such bullshit. It's like, why aren't we looking at this movie? Like, why aren't we just looking at this film?
No, I don't think there's any grooming in here. I mean, there's almost like a joke about it. You know, when at the end they're like, why do we waste so much time? And Armie makes a joke about how he tried to hit on him once. And then his reaction made him be like, oh no, did I go too far?
Yeah.
Why didn't you give me a sign?
I did.
You didn't give me a sign.
I did.
When?
You remember when we were playing volleyball and I touched you just to show you? I liked you. And the way you reacted made me feel like I molested you.
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I just decided I should keep my distance.
And you know what he did after that? He stopped and didn't do it until, like, Timothy came on to him and, like, let him know what was happening.
And it's also the sloppiness of relationships. I mean, that's how relationships work on some level, right? You play games with each other. You flirt, you are maybe a little bit more aggressive, you're not aggressive, you hold back, you're constantly trying to figure out this game. I think that the whole relationship with Marzia is that she's a pawn in this. I think that he is actually attracted to her. I think that he actually likes her, but not in this moment, you know, and there are these elements where this is like all encompassing, so much so that when he sees Armie dancing with that girl, when they're off on their little adventure, like, he vomits. And it's like, he vomits because I think that's the reality of it, right? Like, he knows this is going to end on some level. Like, there's just an emotional, physical response. You can intellectualize it all you want, but he is actually feeling it. Like, I know this is going to happen. Fuck. He may not be able to vocalize it. He may not be able to put words to it, but he knows in his heart,
yeah,
this is doomed.
Yeah, and I mean, to me, this is like the secret sauce of most of Luca's films that have the biggest amount of impact, which is that he makes films about people who are obsessing over things, obsessing over a person, obsessing over an object, mostly obsessing over a person. And he puts obsession in his films with so much like messy earnestness, you know, people leaping in circles when they see a note, smelling people's underwear, that the audience obsesses over his obsessions, right? He makes these just films that like get this core thing out of people because you're like, yes, that is how it feels to be like seething with desires that I'm not able to express out loud.
Yeah.
I mean, my God, when you see Challengers, that is the perviest movie on the planet. Oh my God.
And I love it. I love that like bring back, like that's... On some level, right, isn't that part of romance? That beginning stage of it? Like, I just like this moment where he fucks the peach and then he eats the peach. It's like, it's all encompassing in a way. And there's no better, I think, like showing of that. You can say it in words, but there's some mental thing. I think that that idea of him, like, wanting to fuck him and, you know, and being in that peach and him seeing it and knowing him and accepting him for what he's doing and then really embracing him. But there's something yeah.
and,
there.
And it's Elio like being embarrassed to be caught doing something like yes. that. Being embarrassed to have done something so vulnerable that another person has caught him on. And to, you know, I mean, well, first, can we just hear the peach squelching? And then now could we hear, you know, his reaction when he gets caught.
You've moved on to the plant kingdom already. What's next, minerals? I suppose you've already given up animals. You know, that's me.
I'm sick, aren't I?
I think that America is very good with fucking, and I think that they are very bad with sensuality.
Oh, I think that's incredibly true. I mean, like, so much of the sensuality in the movies that we were raised on in the 80s and 90s was like, here's a girl with gigantic breasts and a sheet wrapped around her just so, you know, whooping yeah. and hollering, and then the sex scene's immediately over.
You know, and it's like, and then when you want to do sex, it's like, we're going to pour a candle wax on you. Or, yeah. you know, it's like it's like some sort of version of like, we, I think, in as an American audience, look at sexuality as being deviant in some way. Well, it's yeah. S&M. It's a little bit more fucked up. It's like, no, but like, I think that like,
we want it to be like shocking. We want it to be like wrong yeah. in some way.
Yeah. And I so there's something really interesting that I think that he captures here, and especially in that scene. And I know a lot of people have a lot to say about that scene, but I think it is like, he is perfect in his eyes and there's no mistake to be made. And there's this like, I will take every part of you.
Is there such a thing as a traveler? Not a Delta, because we know on one flight, Mike in 8C prefers reality TV to reality. So we provide more than 1,000 hours of in-flight entertainment. While on the flight after, 8C is occupied by Jen, whose favorite snack is tea. That's why we provide fast, free Delta Sync Wi-Fi available for SkyMiles members, because at Delta, we know.
Refill?
Everyone flies their own way. Delta, keep climbing. Free Wi-Fi available on most domestic flights. Terms of use apply.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
I find this whole movie to be incredibly and emotionally a tough watch because it puts you back to all those feelings that you have like in your own life. It just ignites them, you know, like just enough that it gets you in your feels again. You know, oh, I remember what that was like. Oh, I remember what that was like. And, you know, I'm in a relationship with my wife now since 2005, you know, very long time. And our relationship is so complex and amazing and wonderful and deeper than it ever was when we first met. But I can long also for the simplicity of when we first met, right? When it was almost just basic, right? And each are equally exciting. I wouldn't want to go back to that, but I also have a fondness for that. You know, and talking about that, like these sex scenes, like this is a movie that I think James Ivory wanted to go full on in. Like he wanted it to be full frontal male nudity, and Chalamet and Armie Hammer are like, nope, we have it in our contracts, we won't do it, even though they really went for it as performers. You know, there were these moments where, you know, they met, they only had one day of rehearsal before the film started shooting, and they're like, let's go and just like go look through the script and see what's going on. Now, the whole movie, everyone would go back to Luca's villa at night. He'd cook them a big meal. They'd watch movies. They'd talk about the film. They were like living almost together. So this first day, Chalamet had been in Italy for a month, learning Italian, learning how to play those piano pieces. Armie Hammer comes in and they're like, all right, let's just do a scene. And the first scene is the two of them rolling on the ground and kissing passionately. And he's like, all right, let's go. And so they committed to that, you know, and they committed to that in every way. Like Luca would be like more passionate. So they just kept on making out and it had to be almost pulled apart. And that was like this rehearsal for them. It's like, okay, that's us. The sensuality is there, but they were not going to have the nakedness. And I don't think you need nakedness. I think in a weird way, it would take away from the film. I will say that you talked about CGI flies. There's definitely CGI ball removal.
Oh, I have heard about this, but let's let Armie and Luca and Timmy and also Michael Spielberg talk about this.
Were your balls coming out of the short shorts? Talk to me about the science you know of that? Armie's short shorts, Luca.
Tell the story.
A lot of visual effect.
Yes.
Tell the story.
There was a few times where they had to go back and digitally remove my balls.
Is that
from
true?
The movie.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
Wow.
There were short shorts. What are you going to do?
They were.
Well, it's both things.
Yes. And so, did you say it's means. Both things?
Whatever that means.
Short shorts
and big balls. That's what you're saying. Wow. So Armie Hammer has going,
my mom's going to love listening to this
Armie
interview.
Hammer has big balls is what you're saying.
No, I'm not saying it. I had to remove digitally.
You had to digitally remove
and
Armie's balls.
Put them in another place.
Yes,
in
they're
the,
another place.
If you look around, floating around like movie. Where's Waldo?
Those are the Easter eggs.
If you look carefully at all the trees, it's not all
the
peaches.
Yeah. I found out about it because I saw the GQ article that was titled, Armie Hammer's balls had to be edited out of Call Me By Your Name. And it just really made me remember the wild ass response to this movie when it came out. You know, like, I think it's more normal even just now, even just like 7 years later, to be able to talk about these films without having to like shout at the top of your lungs, like, it's actors who are straight doing something we don't expect them to do. And oh my gosh, and here we go. And here's all our jokes and here's all our puns.
You're right. I think that, look, it's not embarrassing, but it's like, oh, how do we talk about this? Is it weird? Is it not weird? And for as open as we all are, not we, but I think culturally, it's like the peach scene becomes the oh, you fucked the peach movie, you know? And it's like, okay, yeah, sure. I mean, that is an element in the movie. You know, it's the same way like Basic Instinct got reduced down to like, you saw her vagina.
Yeah, or American Pie.
Yeah,
oh,
fuck
no,
the pie.
You know what he did to the pie. And I mean, you have to respect that, like, Luca and Timmy, even knowing that was going to happen, gave interviews with like, yeah, we both tried it. We want to make sure it worked. We both fucked a peach. Guess what? You could fuck a peach. Now you know. And, you know, not to even throw like GQ under the bus, because like now that the movie became like such an established, beloved hit, now they're running like much more just ordinary, tame headlines. Like one from a couple years ago was, Why Call Me By Your Name is still the film to watch for summer style tips. Do you want a summer style tip? I took
By the way, some good summer style in there.
Yeah. One, double denim is an easy win. Two, earthy hues ensure elegance. Three, you need some short shorts.
Too short for me. My thighs can't handle those shorts.
You play pickleball. You should be able to
run those. Yeah, well, you know, but they're too short for me.
Okay.
I do think that, like, you're right. Like, there's this discourse around the movie that I think belittles it a little bit. But I do believe that, honestly, the nudity, it was a smart choice, because I think then people would just be talking about dick size. You know, it's like Fassbender's dick. It's like everyone wants to talk about it. Like, who cares? Like, that, it's not like, it's the least interesting thing. And it's like that belittles the movie. So I do think that while James Ivory wanted it, I think it was really smart for Armie and for Timothy not to do it. I think it actually would, to your point, veer the discourse in a place where we don't need it to go.
Yeah. And also, you know, I would say that Timothy and Armie are actors who have been alive when they know that everything's going to be screen grabbed and on the internet in a minute. And James Ivory is slightly more old school, where maybe that's not at the first thing at the head of his mind. He's thinking probably in terms of the way that, you know, I think was a noble way to think in the 80s when he was making films like Maurice, you know, where really similar film that he did in 1987, where it's like Hugh Grant kind of has the Army Hammer role. He's in love with his friend in college. It's pre-war England. They make out in the grass a lot, but they won't consummate anything. And then Hugh finally goes and gets married. You know, he's like, I couldn't do things like that back then. So I want to do them now that we can, which is, there's an argument to that. But I also, you know, if I were an actor, there's no way I'd want screen grabs of myself out there forever.
No, it's too much. I think especially now because things can become just memed. I think back in the day, you'd have to like really search for it, but people had it like Mr. Skin, you know, 3492, you know, 3428, you'll see so-and-so's boobs, you know, it's like, oh God, you know, So I think that that kind of stuff complicates it because we're not able to have those conversations in a way where we can look at it. But this is a movie that I also think takes two men, and we talked about this back on Brokeback Mountain. You know, here is a director who has made a lot of movies about gay culture, or embracing this element with two men who are not gay. Which is interesting too. And by the way, Armie Hammer, scandal noted, understand that there's other things got to play, but you know, it is interesting to kind of put these guys in that world. And I was thinking about that too. It's like, and I like the choice because I think it, because it's done in 1985, it really once again adds another layer to the Armie Hammer character. He is somebody who appears in a world in 1985 when we meet those two men who are gay. He appears to be the anti-version of that, right? And I think that that's interesting to know that about him. And I think with Timothée Chalamet, you know, he falls into this other category of, you know, of being like, I know he's like a waify kind of, everyone loves him and he's a great actor, but
doesn't he look like such a kid in this? You know, he has that such really a lurching walk, and the costuming, I think, very smartly puts him in just like oversized clothes that don't fit him very well. You know, he doesn't look like a grown up at the beginning. Is it, you know, by the end when he like shows up in more of a sophisticated shirt and a scarf, he does look like he has matured over this year.
Well, he fits into the shirt of a man at the end.
Yeah, he literally fits into the Armie Hammer shirt, you know?
But I love the way that you see him at the end. Like, he's matured. He's grown up. And, you know, these are the things that help us grow and help us learn. You know, that's the other part of this is, like, you may have your heart broken. You may feel these things that wreck you to your core, but they are the building blocks of what make you interesting. When he comes into that room at the end, and months have passed, he is way more interesting. He is like, whoa, who's this guy? Like, something happened in him.
Yeah, he's like stopped feeling like such a frustrated twerp, you know? And I like it the way that we see like his frustration. You know, he's pacing around the house in the summer, being really annoyed, picking up books, being really floppy, hearing Armie Hammer's voice in his head when he like comes across notes that like Armie Hammer has left behind. And that idea of just like having nothing that's filling him up in a way that satisfies him.
Absolutely. You know,
and also just being a dork. Like, one of my favorite moments in the film is like when Armie is trying to broker some peace and he's like, do you want to go to town? And the way Timothy just answers him like a sarcastic child.
Yes, I love that scene. Also love that when they do go to town, you see the two little references. The movie that is very devoid of anything that feels of 1985, I believe you see a poster for Tootsie and a picture of the half-built Death Star from Return of the Jedi on a cover of a newspaper.
Oh, wow. I didn't notice that. But I do like the way the 80s looks here. It feels like more legit 80s than, oh, God, now we're just doing all those films where we like keep doing 80s and 90s costuming, but it's not how anybody actually dressed. It's way too cartoonish. This feels more real.
Well, I also think that, right. It's like you get that Wedding Singer version of it, the parody version of it. This movie is timeless. I get it in the 80s, but it doesn't make a difference. It doesn't make a difference.
No, I mean, I think what does make a difference is like, you know, the villa that they're living in, that's a villa that was built in the 1600s, but it has 14 rooms and 7 bathrooms. It was recently for sale. So like we know this now. And I'm like, 7 bathrooms. Do they really, really need to share? But then I was like, you know what, Amy, be fair.
And good repair. Are all of them working?
Oh, okay, fair. I mean, the Saltburn estate, you know, where it's also two guys sharing a bathroom, that has 127 rooms. So the idea that they have to share bathrooms there just feels even more like, all right, guys, all right.
All right, I just want to go back to the peach for a second, because we're talking about it, and we're talking about sex, we're talking about all this sort of stuff, and just something just clicked with me, because that scene has been, you know, on my head, in my head for a little bit now. And it's this. What is the most classic love story of all time?
Oh, whoa. Are you asking me?
I'm asking you.
Paul and June.
Yes, exactly. Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And to me, that's a movie where one of the characters is so in love with this character that they barely know. They kill themselves when they think the other one is dead. But the other one is faking, you know, like that's right. And that's like this extreme act. And we talk about that, like, oh my God, they loved each other so much that they, you know, they killed each other. We don't go, oh my God, can you believe?
Yeah.
She killed herself. She fucking killed herself.
Yeah.
Fucking ate that peach. You know, it's like,
I
why
feel like
do we
real
look
growth
at
that? For me was in high school when I was able to be like, wait a second. They're idiots.
Yeah. They're yeah. kids. Yeah. Like, right. It's like, but I guess like there's like this thing of like, oh, that's true love. And it's like, but yet we're like, oh, Peach is fucking weird. And I don't know, that just made me laugh. Like thinking about that dichotomy of those two scenes. It's the same thing. It's like star-crossed. I don't know if they're star-crossed, but they are people from opposite sides. They come together, they find each other, and they're immediately connected. They are finding this bond that is unbreakable. And, you know, obviously they have different obstacles in front of them. Here, obviously, the family is very supportive. But I guess the end result is the same. It's like, it's, you know, it's, I would do anything for you, including kill myself. And that's viewed as romantic, but the peach is viewed as like, gross. Gross, bro. Anyway, I mean, I just absolutely love this movie. I love the rewatch of this movie. I think that I'm excited for Challengers. I'm nervous for Challengers,
it's
which
a
I
lot.
Think is like
it's a real different tone. It's a real different style. It is. How you commented that this one has like a very straightforward, simple, beautiful pace and look on 35mm. Oh, Challengers is just like, let me invent new camera angles in every single scene. It is wild.
Oh, I cannot wait. I cannot wait. Well, Amy, you know, I know we talked about Brokeback Mountain here just briefly, but I actually thought it would be good to kind of throw it back to Brokeback in a way, because I think it's another interesting conversation about a movie that breaks through in a very interesting way, a movie that I think connects with people in a way that they probably were surprised by. And I think tackles similar issues in a certain respect and is a period piece. Would you like to go back and take a listen to what we talked about back then?
Let's do it. You know, Paul, what if after this we do Catherine Bigelow's Point Break with none other than Keanu Reeves
and Patrick Swayze? Hell yeah. All right. That's a romance. That is, they would eat peaches jumping out of fucking airplanes. That's what I love about it. Let's do it. Let's get them all in there. I can't wait to do Point Break. I think it's a great way to celebrate the release of the brand new Fall Guy, which is celebrating stunts in film. Point Break is available wherever you get your media. I mean, you can get it from the library. You can get it from my house if you want to just borrow my amazing 4K transfer Blu-ray. Whatever you want, you can get Point Break and watch extra features. It's going to blow your mind. And also my book, Joyful Recollections of Trauma, is coming out this May. I'm on a book tour. You can check out my site or the Unspooled site to see where you can find me. Talking with great people like Adam Savage and Adam Pally and Busy Phillips and more surprises. So Amy, what a pleasure it's been. Our show could not be done without our team, and a huge thank you goes to them each and every week. Produced and edited by Cody Fisher, and our associate producer, Jessica Cisneros. Our engineer is Casey Holford, and our MVP is Molly Reynolds. Our theme song is by Michael Cassidy, and our fan art is by Kim Troxell. Check it out all on social media, and you can find us on social media at Unspooled on Twitter and Instagram, and you can join in the conversation about all things Unspooled on the Paul Scheer Discord at discord.gg/Paul Scheer. There's an entire Unspooled section T-shirts, mugs, stickers, and all Unspooled merch are available at tpublic.com/unspooled, and you can get a deck of Unspooled playing cards and more merch at podswag.com. That's right. And if you can't get enough Unspooled, you can listen to our archive for free anywhere you get your podcast. But remember to rate and review us. It does help. And finally, you can always check out the API list. That's right, the ever-growing list that we will eventually shoot into space at unspooled.com. And just a reminder, my book, Joyful Recollections of Trauma, comes out May 21st. You can pre-order it now, and if you do, I'll be so thankful. See you next time. Bye for now.
At Delta, we know Mike in 8C prefers reality TV to reality. So we provide more than 1,000 hours of in-flight entertainment. On the next flight, 8C is Mandy, a foodie. So we offer all types of food options. Because at Delta, everyone flies their own way. Delta, keep climbing.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.